From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made just about a month ago in the pages of the Washington Post. An unexpected article, especially for the organ donor community in this country. The piece was written by Michael Polson, who is an MD candidate at Georgetown University, and himself an organ donor. He donated a kidney at age 18. Polson's piece was about how he regrets having donated that kidney now, years later, looking back. As an MD candidate and someone in the medical system, he has spent more time researching kidney donation, organ donation, the risks, the long-term effects. And he came to the conclusion that the risks were undersold, that the safety was essentially oversold. We'll get into that. Well, at least we'll find out if he feels that that is a fair summation of his views coming up here. Because we're going to talk to Michael Polson. Want to let you know that later this hour, we're going to talk to the local organ donor community, members of it. And there is a pretty strong pushback from the organ donor community in this country, a pushback against Michael Polson's piece and the sentiments expressed. Not in a personal way, but certainly in a substantive way. You're going to hear that coming up. But first, I want to welcome Michael Polson, an MD candidate at Georgetown, the author of that piece, and someone who has wanted to spark a conversation about the realities of organ donation. And Michael, I want to start by asking you if you are surprised that your piece in the Post has landed you in so many different places, sparked so much discussion.
It's been very unexpected. So I wrote this piece kind of as a capstone for med school, and it's kind of been a work in progress for many years now. I think it's interesting that people are focusing on the regret, because that was something that I kind of thought about as I was writing this. It was something that kind of came as an afterthought as I started kind of thinking about everything and thinking about all the information that was coming out and actually really dwelling on that. I wrote this as a capstone, trying to get it published somewhere. Never thought it would be published in the Washington Post. So it's amazing that so many people have read it now, and it's really kind of just surreal that now I'm talking to you as well about it.
Michael, how did it end up in the Washington Post?
So I submitted it to different places, and I submitted it to a publisher at the Washington Post, and they were interested in it. We made some changes and published it.
And for you, that was just about a month ago. How quickly did you hear feedback?
Pretty much right away. I was getting emails and texts from people. I was getting texts saying I was on the front page of Yahoo News, and getting emails that I was on these different listservs. So it was actually pretty quickly. And considering it was on a Sunday, for it to be that quick was pretty amazing.
Did you know the likelihood that people would be, at least some people would be upset or push back?
Yeah, I mean, I completely expected people to be, I'm not sure about upset, but I knew there would be some pushback. Because the title itself, I think, was very kind of sensationalized, and I think that's what people really focused on. And I mean, regret was such a small part of the piece, and as I talked about, it was such a small part of why I wrote it, and it was more of an afterthought. But I mean, I was fully expecting people to push back, because I mean, there are a lot of people who absolutely do not regret donating, and there's a lot of research to support that, and I don't think anybody should ever regret donating. I just didn't expect people to have that much of a reaction. And again, I think it's from the title that was posted online. So yeah, I guess now looking back, I should have expected as much pushback. But I think a lot of people kind of just read the title and didn't necessarily read into the article itself, which
sure,
again, was very little about regret. That's the last line of my piece. It's more about kind of the research into living kidney donation.
Listeners, I'll just remind you again, the name of the piece, the title they chose, and I'm sure Michael didn't choose it, was "At 18 Years Old, He Donated a Kidney, Now He Regrets It." And it's an emotional subject. It's emotional if you've donated, because all of a sudden you may be thinking about, well, should I regret it? It's emotional if you're waiting for one. It's emotional for donor networks. So I guess I'm not surprised at some of the response that you've gotten. And in a moment, we're going to work through some of the, I guess, the arguments and the comments that you make in the piece. But just to kind of make sure we're clear on this, I say people were sort of upset. What's the most vehement reaction that you received for this, Michael?
There were enough comments on the piece itself and on kind of the Facebook post by the Washington Post of people who were just very angry. I've been called a lot of words on there that I'm not going to repeat on the air, but I mean, of everybody I know, and I know people who have received kidneys, I think a lot of people really kind of understood the message if they kind of read into the article and got past the title. But I think most of the pushback and most of the anger was certainly online. And I mean, I haven't talked to many people within the transplant community, so I'm not sure what their reaction is. But I'm sure there are definitely mixed feelings even there.
Well, the word regret is in your title. And as you say, you feel it's a little sensationalized the way the title was written for the Washington Post. So I will just ask you, do you regret having that piece in the Washington Post?
No, absolutely not. I certainly have mixed feelings about the title. I don't like it because the regret was such a small part of the piece. And, I mean, a lot of people focused on the 18 part of it as well, and there were a lot of comments about the age of consent and so on and so forth. But at the same time, a lot of people read it, and I don't think they would have read it if it didn't have that title. So, no, absolutely not. I am so glad that people read it, and there's so many people who were so understanding and so many people that didn't realize a lot of the information in the piece who now kind of have a better understanding of the process as a whole.
Talking to Michael Polson, who is a fourth-year medical student at Georgetown, his piece in early October in the Washington Post was about kidney donation and the fact that he was 18 years old and donated a kidney and now looks back with some second thoughts, especially regarding the information that he now has but maybe didn't have at the time. And so, Michael, let's talk about this. You were 18 years old. What led you to donate?
I was in high school at the time and was just kind of realizing that I wanted to go into medicine. And at my high school, we were able to shadow doctors and nurses as part of this healthcare vocation class. So I was able to go to the emergency room, the operating room, and one of my weeks was actually spent at an interventional nephrology unit where they placed dialysis ports and changed dialysis ports. But also in this area of the hospital was where people in kidney failure received dialysis. And if you've ever been on a dialysis unit, you'll know that's really eye-opening. It's just rows of person after person sitting in a chair, filtering their blood. And they go so often that you start to see them over and over for many hours per day. And they all just look exhausted. And I think being so young, it was kind of hard to forget. And it really made a big impression on me. So the next year when I turned 18, during my first year of college, I decided to get tested and get more information. And then, as you know, I ended up donating.
You donated, and how much information did you feel like you had at the time? Give me a sense of what your mindset was leading up to that donation and then maybe in the days after.
Yeah. So, I mean, it took the course of my entire freshman year to go through all the testing. And I think that might be a little bit unusual for me just because I was in school. And I mean, they certainly give you information, but I guess the information they give you is they focus on this one piece of information that the rate of kidney failure in donors is the same as the general population. And so as a layperson, somebody who really wasn't involved in the medical system as much yet, that sounded awesome. I mean, it sounds like you're at no increased risk of end-stage kidney disease. So really, I had no worries about the process because they also talk about the post-operative complications, which are exceedingly low. I mean, it's just basically the risk of anesthesia. So that's with anybody who undergoes surgery. And I mean, that's kind of the one thing that was repeated to me over and over. It's kind of the one thing that made me feel really good about donating. And I just kind of wondered why other people wouldn't donate if they kind of knew what I knew at the time. So, yeah, I mean, they give you all the information that I guess they knew or that they were willing to share. That's kind of the one thing that sticks with me now.
Now, looking back, one of the reasons you write this piece is you start understanding or at least working through the research better, and you come to some different conclusions. Tell me about that.
That was kind of an evolution over my time doing research, which was before and during medical school. And now it's kind of amazing to me that 50 years after the first living donation, we're just now coming to realize that in the last couple of years that there might be an increased risk of kidney disease. I mean, when I donated, there weren't as many of these studies suggesting an increased risk in donors. There were some smaller studies that really didn't follow donors for an extended period of time. And all these kind of show that the risk was the same as the general population. And that was what was repeated to donors before they donated. But I think people started to realize that a lot of the complications come later down the road. And now these most recent studies, which were coming out around 2014, which I had already started medical school at that point, are suggesting an increased risk of kidney failure in donors compared to controls, which are matched for similar health status. And this is important because the general population is very different donors, because donors have to be screened to be the healthiest of the population. So these newer studies are looking at kidney donors compared to controls that are just as healthy but didn't donate. And these studies show that although the risk is still incredibly low, it's less than 1%, the risk of kidney failure is higher than these controls. And in some of these studies, the risk was up to 8 times higher in donors compared to their controls. And there are other studies that have even suggested that donors may have an increased risk of cardiovascular disease and overall mortality, obviously just as worrisome.
I know you've read some of the pushback from, say, Vox.com. Vox had a piece where a donor said, wanted to work through some of the points that you make in your piece, and goes on to say, this donor does not regret it and feels differently than you do. And I want to kind of touch on some of that. In the Vox piece, I'm just going to quote from it, quote, it is simply inaccurate for Polson to say that we do not know the number of kidney donors whose kidneys fail or what happens to them when they do, end quote. What do you say to that?
I mean, that was actually reflected in a letter to the editor, too. And, you know, I address it in the piece, which I'm kind of surprised that people are still kind of confused about it. But a lot of our data and a lot of these studies are based off of UNOS data, which is the United Network for Organ Sharing. And as I talked about in the article, this data is very incomplete. So we've only been able to track kidney donors who developed kidney failure since 1996, when donors were given an extra 4 points that allowed them to bump to the top of the kidney donor waiting list. And this 4-point allocation is what allowed UNOS to track people who developed kidney failure. But even after 1996, it still misses anyone who chooses not to be listed for transplant. So if somebody decides to stay on dialysis and not be listed, or those who did not mention that they were a former donor when they were listed, or even those who just directly received a living kidney without having to be listed for a deceased kidney. And it obviously doesn't include anybody between the 1950s, between the first living donor transplant, and the 1990s, who may have donated.
So what's the short way to say this, Michael, is that do you think donors were oversold on the safety of this donation?
Yes, I think so. It's hard for me to say that there was any malintent on the part of the transplant programs, but I think it's misleading to say that the risk of kidney failure in donors is the same as the general population, because, I mean, as you kind of delve into it, you realize that the general population is not as healthy. And, I mean, the plain truth is we don't necessarily know the risk because there's not as much information out there. I mean, we don't have the full information of donors who have gone into kidney failure. So I think the truth is we don't necessarily know, but as these newer studies are coming out, it's suggesting that donors are at increased risk compared to people who were just as healthy. And especially now that these new studies are coming out, I would hope transplant programs would tell people that they are at increased risk and that they would communicate that there's not as much research out there as there should be.
That's Michael Polson, who's an MD candidate at Georgetown University and an organ donor himself. And again, his piece in the Washington Post sparking this conversation. So you've heard his perspective. We'll post his op-ed as well through our Twitter accounts. And I want to welcome a panel in studio now who's going to respond to what you heard from not only from Michael Polson, but also tell their own stories and discuss, I think, some different perspectives on organ donation. First of all, Yanti Slobert is here. He's a kidney transplant recipient. He looks great. I've read his story in the Democrat and Chronicle. How are you feeling?
I'm doing great. Wonderful. I'm blessed.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
When was your transplant?
May 10th of this year.
May 10th.
Yes.
Well, I'm glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And you're looking really, really good. In fact, let me bring in Aaron Matil and Annette Matil. Aaron is a kidney donor who we're going to talk about sort of the fact that she's kind of Yanti's donor, except for kind of not. It's an interesting trade situation, but we'll explore that. Aaron and Annette, thank you so much for taking the time to be here. It's nice to see both of you.
Thank you for having us.
And also in studio is Erica Venero, who is a clinical manager for kidney transplant and the URMC Division of Solid Organ Transplant. Erica, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
And Jeremy Taylor. Dr. Taylor is clinical director of nephrology for the URMC Division of Solid Organ Transplant. Dr. Taylor, welcome to you
Great,
as well.
Thank you.
I know you saw the piece, Dr. Taylor, and I'd just like to start with you before we kind of go into these really compelling personal stories that are right here at the table, right here in this room. His piece, what Michael Polson is saying, is that He's not telling people don't donate, but he's saying that the system's got to be more transparent and that there's a little bit of overselling the safety and underselling the risk. You think he's wrong?
No, I don't think he's wrong. I mean, I think transplant centers are beginning to get a better grasp on this. I think as Mr. Paulson mentioned in his article that, you know, these articles are relatively new. You know, these studies are relatively new. And certainly when he donated, you know, 6 or 8 years ago, it sounds like, you know, we didn't have all this information. We now have more information available. And, you know, certainly transplant centers like ourselves are starting to use this information and actually having more open discussions now with donors about what the risk may be. We're still learning about this. We're still trying to get more information. I think, you know, the donors go through an extremely rigorous process, you know, to screen them. And the donors that do come through that screening process are extremely, extremely healthy individuals, and they do very, very well. But you know, there are some risks with donating a kidney, and I think we're learning more about that now.
Erica, when I first read the piece, of course, I noted the headline as well, and you heard Michael in the interview indicate he didn't choose the headline there. It was a little sensationalistic that they put that regret front and center when all he wanted was kind of to discuss the lack of what he thought was total transparency. What did you make of the piece when you first read it?
You know, I had mixed emotions from both sides. I appreciated the fact that, you know, first of all, that he kind of diminished the fact that he felt like he was a hero. I mean, anybody who does come forward should be seen as a hero for doing this. It's a pretty, you know, selfless act. It's something that's so giving. I appreciated also that he was being honest with how he felt. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, with donors, they get so caught up in the excitement of the donation that, you know, sometimes it's good to take a step back and kind of look at the whole process and the whole journey, because it really is truly a whole journey. You know, ideally, if he was able to do that prior to his donation, you know, I think that maybe that word regret wouldn't have lingered as long as it had.
Sure, and I think that there's this interesting kind of ambivalence some people might feel about that headline, because the headline itself is going to cause more people to read it and to talk about it, which may be a productive outcome. And yet, I'm wondering if you and if Dr. Taylor are concerned that the headline itself, for the people who don't read it, may convince people who are thinking about donating not to. Are you concerned about that, Erica?
You know, I'm not, because if somebody really truly wants to do it, they're going to go through with it, and they're going to do the research, and they're going to look at the other side of the coin, and they're going to seek out the information. You know, so no, I'm not that concerned. And if anything, it brings the idea that, you know, for some people that, you know, didn't even know that organ donation, you know, particularly for kidneys, is an option. So, you know, on the other end, this is maybe bringing a subject to light that in a positive way.
Okay. Dr. Taylor?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think it brings organ donation to the forefront, and I think that's what we need more of. We need more education, and I think it's important, you know, even if the initial sort of title of the article seems negative, I'm hoping that people would at least take the time to read the article and read through it and really get to understand that, you know, that organ donation is very important, you know, that there are 100,000 people on the kidney transplant waiting list waiting for a kidney transplant. And we're only transplanting, you know, less than 20,000 of those every year. And there are 5,000 people every year dying on the wait list waiting for a kidney transplant. So it's important to get that information out there. We, you know, we need more organ donors. We need more, you know, great people like Aaron here, who is able to donate a kidney. And again, you can sort of see how wonderful Yonti looks and how great Yonti's done. And that wouldn't have happened without people like Aaron. So
before I turn to their story, I'm curious to know if, given the fact that you think Michael Paulson made some important points about transparency and making sure potential donors have the best information out there. Again, everybody wants more research. Sure. We all want longer sample sizes, more longitudinal studies. But do you have people who are going through this process who decide, once they have that kind of information that you offer, that the best you can, do they pull out? Do they say, this is not right? You know, or at least I'm not yet there.
Yeah, it's unusual. I mean, again, the screening process is fairly rigorous. There's multiple steps to that screening process.
Really, so usually by the time they get to
the
you,
by the time they really come in and get to us, they've really sort of gone through that journey, that part of the journey. But there are some that will come to us more for sort of information. And, you know, when we give them the information, they may decide either to wait longer or to think it over more. But generally, the people that come to us actually sort of get through that initial screening process, they really want to donate. And usually, and studies have shown this, that the donors will take a much greater risk than we're able to accept. So usually it's the physicians that are usually saying, look, you know, this risk is too high here. We can't do this. The donors are often the ones that are sort of pushing us to sort of say, we really want to donate, but we're often having to say them they can't because of certain reasons. So.
Listeners, if you want to join the conversation about organ donation, kidney donation, if you want to share your own story, or if you've got questions about the process or about the research, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I will revisit the question on the research, and we'll at least get back to there to, you know, like, let's take us through this. What should we know about what we do and do not know about safety and long-term possibilities? But I think we got to give credit to Corey Putnam and the Democrat and Chronicle for sharing a story. And if you haven't heard it yet, Yanti Slobert's story, Aaron Mattil, and Aaron and Annette are here. It is remarkable. And so let's talk a little bit about this. Yanti, you mentioned that your kidney transplant was May 10th.
May 10th of this year, yes.
You feel good.
I feel great. I feel blessed.
You look great. I hear you gained back some of the weight you had lost.
Oh, yes, I did.
When you read this piece, as someone who's gone through this and needed it yourself, how did you feel?
I had a fear that people would not read the piece and they would be like, I'm not going to, you know, donate any kidneys.
See the headline
and
think.
I thought they would turn away from it. So I was in fear of that happening.
I know you want other people who have the same needs that you did.
Yes.
To have the same kind of an outcome. And I say outcome, and we're 6 months later.
Just 6 months later.
I am totally ignorant on this process. So 6 months, it's a great sign. No signs of rejection. Everything is going well?
No, not at all. Everything's going well.
How often are you know, sort of getting checked and kind of going back and assessing?
I have then graduated to once every other month. So that's a huge, huge jump. At one time, it was twice a week. And then now it's once every other month.
And eventually it becomes what?
It becomes what?
I mean, once a year, so at one point. I mean, we'll follow blood work in between, but we'll get into a point where we're seeing them once a year.
Yeah.
You're looking forward to that?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. is there a sense now, Yanti, that because you've gotten to that six-month mark, that concern, again, that here's my ignorance speaking, that concerns about rejection or possible complication are not going to be there for you?
No, it's always a worry. It can happen at any time. So I'm trying to be as careful as possible, always asking questions, doing some research, have some great conversations with my doctors here to make sure that I'm on the right track. So that conversation is constantly happening.
Well, I say it's a remarkable story. I mean, every organ donation that's a success story is a remarkable story. It's a remarkable story of modern medicine. And I think, like, just like Erica said, willingness to step up and do something that, you know, that you don't have to do. Aaron and Annette, I want to know how you, first of all, how you knew Yanti and how this all kind of came to the forefront. They're sharing a microphone, so it's okay. You can trade it back and forth, but I want you to tell our listeners how you knew Yanti and how this decision to donate a kidney came about here.
I'm actually friends with...
Go ahead and grab that right on that microphone. There you go. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm friends with Yanti's wife, Rachel, and we've known each other for about 5 or 6 years now, and... And then I met Aaron 4 years ago, and so she met Rachel through me, and then we heard about his story, and sort of flowed from there.
So you knew there was a need, but Aaron is not Yanti's size, as the Democrat and Chronicle points out in the picture that you see. Tell me about the complication, or what you thought going into this process when you thought maybe this is something that I want to do. Take me through that.
It was crazy. It's a real journey, as you said before, personal growth. I mean, initially, I think against Yanti's wishes, his wife sort of put a plea out on Facebook, you know, for people to come in and get tested. And I thought, okay, well, you know what, I can do that. Let's have a bunch of people do it. I apparently was one of hundreds, I guess.
About 68.
Okay, yeah. Well, dozens. Something
okay.
like that.
All right.
people that showed up and... I just sort of kept passing the steps, and so it just sort of started to become almost it was like an opportunity that revealed itself to me as I was getting, and it became sort of like a test of my own character for me. Can I do something? Can I be as good of a person as I feel like I am? You know, can I demonstrate that? And this would be, it became something that was really, I think, just... I really have a hard time putting it into words, but it was such an opportunity for me to be a better person, that I almost feel like it was something Yanti was doing for me.
Well, I want to clarify a couple of things. Yanti, why did you tell your wife not to do that?
It had to do with pride. I'm a very proud person. I'm a very private person. And we were dealing with this for a year, and my wife allowed me not to tell anyone about it for a year.
Pride, but yes. I don't mean to be sort of overly blunt here, but you were almost dying.
Yes. I know it's hard to explain, but
okay.
I felt that, you know, we can work it out. Something will happen. And my wife just hit me aside the head one day and said, "You idiot, you know, a kidney's not going to fall from the sky. You have to get the message out there. You have to let people know that you need help." Because my entire life, we always help others, and I was never in need. And this is my first time in need, so it was just, okay, let's do it. Let's do it. You're right. I'm not just here for myself. We have a 10-month-old at the time. Wow. I'm married now, so we do need to get the word out.
Well, we can ask for help.
Yes, exactly.
You were in renal failure?
Yes.
End stage renal failure,
September of 2014.
Most of our listeners have never been through that and may not even have a friend or a family member who's been through that. What was daily life like at that moment?
Difficult. Constantly, no energy whatsoever. There were times I could not even get out of bed. And what hurt me the most is I was not a father to my 10-month-old son. And his entire life, he only knew dad was sick. So he would come home from daycare, his daddy in bed, his daddy sick. And we try to keep that away from him, but he would hear it from other people. And he started to question when he was able to talk at the time, "Is daddy sick? Is daddy in bed?" And there were times that I could not even leave the house. I was so tired, so fatigued. And my wife will take my son out so he can have a life. I wanted them to live. I didn't want them to be imprisoned with my illness. I want them to grow and have a life. And she would take them on outings, and I could never join them. And it felt really horrible because I didn't have a father growing up. So I really needed to be a father to my son.
Yeah. You needed a match. Not easy to find. How tall are you?
6'3".
6'3".
Yes.
Again, I'm not an expert in this. Maybe Dr. Taylor can help fill me in here on the value of, or the challenge, I guess, of finding a match and what exactly you're looking for.
Yeah, so, I mean, with Yanti's case, I mean, as Yanti said, he had, you know, multiple people sort of come forward interested in donating. And so there are several steps that we have to go through. I mean, if you first need to find a blood type match, and then there's what we call tissue typing, which are more specific tissue markers that sort of identify self. And so you have to match from that standpoint. And then you have to go through all the health characteristics and make sure the donor is healthy. And in this situation, you know, Aaron actually was a match as far as blood type and tissue type. But the issue that came up with Aaron and Yanti was a size match. And, you know, Yanti is, you know, even at that point, you know, 6'3", I don't know, 250.
At that point,
your weight was down.
You were down to 181?
He was very sick, wow. So he lost a lot of weight. Wow. And so we realized that if Aaron donated to Yanti, that he really wouldn't be enough of a kidney for Yanti once he got his muscle mass back, once he felt better. And so, you know, they have these national programs, the pair donor exchange programs, which allow us to find a better match for Yanti. And Aaron was very gracious to sort of decide that she was willing to do this. And we were able to find a much better match, a size match for Yanti. Aaron was donated a kidney, and she was able to help another individual.
Kind of a swap.
A swap. And so through this process, multiple people ended up getting transplanted. And so these organ chains are fantastic because it's helping multiple people across the country.
Are these swaps common?
They're becoming more common. Hmm. It's sort of growing over the last, you know, sort of 10 years. We've done a record number of swaps here in Rochester this year. And, you know, this is a process that's going to continue to grow, and I think we're going to do more of these in the future.
Aaron, if I would have told you your kidney would become a bargaining chip, I mean, like, that's just never something in your own mind that probably ever came into play for you, was it?
I had never heard of it. It was... I was basically initially told, you're not a match, you're sort of out. And mm-hmm. then they reapproached, and I thought that was the end of it. And I was reapproached later about this swap situation. And am I interested in hearing more about it? Yeah, because at this point, Rachel and Yanti are my family. And if there's a way for me to stay in the game, you know, I want to do that.
Let me ask you, though, you know, because again, I think you're a you're a better person than me. I haven't, you know, gone through the process that you did. And you said that you're almost challenging yourself to find out, can I be the person that I would like to think that I am? You go through most of that process, you're clearing all these hurdles, but then they come to say, you're not a match, you know, he's 8 feet tall, your happy size, and it's just not going to work. Was there any relief in your mind at all, even in the back of your mind, thinking, okay, I don't have to do this?
No, I'm...
It was a disappointment.
I'm extremely stubborn, and when I set my mind on something, I really need to follow through on that. I was disappointed and frustrated to be told no more than once, so it was very on again, off again, and... I wouldn't let it go. I guess I'm just stubborn that way. But yeah, I was very disappointed at the idea that this opportunity was maybe going to be taken away mm-hmm. from me. It became very personal to me.
Can I ask your wife how she felt just about the process? I mean, I do know people who have, I have a friend, for example, who donated to a colleague. And there was a lot to go through as a family to make sure, are we feeling good about this donation? Are we feeling like we know enough to feel confident? How did you feel?
Oh, I was very proud of her. You know, this whole process, it was, it had its ups and downs. As you know, when she was told no, she was really upset, you know, and then she got back up on the horse and, you know, tried to really pursue it. So it, very, very proud of her.
Did you have any relief when she was initially told couldn't do it?
No, I felt bad for her. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I know it meant a lot to her, so it meant a lot to us, and we made sure that, like, our kids knew about it mm-hmm. and that, you know, they were constantly in the loop of what was going on, so.
Wow. It is an amazing story. So the transplant was May 10th. When did you find out, by the way? How long was that bargaining chip kidney out there in play there, Aaron? I mean, how long did you have to wait before you knew that this swap was going to be able to happen?
I don't have a head for
facts. I think the final yes was like
maybe February.
So this is a matter of months.
It was a few months.
Just a matter of a few months.
It wasn't all that long.
Okay. I'll tell you that the first time I went for blood work was, I think, a year and a half before the transplant. Mm-hmm. So it's a long process for sure.
How are you feeling?
I feel great. I feel physically the same as I always did, and I feel emotionally just, I mean, amazing. I really haven't had to change my lifestyle at all.
Hmm. Yeah. How long did it take you after that transplant to feel sort of like you always did?
I think that fatigue was the biggest factor, mm-hmm. And some soreness and discomfort, but overall... I mean, I had a nice rest. I was off of work for about 6 weeks, and enjoyed every minute of that. And I would say after maybe about 3 months, I was feeling pretty much 100%. But I was feeling very normal after just a couple of weeks, other than just being tired.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
We're late for our only break, but if you're just joining us, the impetus for this discussion was that op-ed in the Washington Post last month, titled, "At 18 Years Old, He Donated a Kidney and Now He Regrets It." It was written by an MD candidate at Georgetown University named Michael Polson. We talked to him earlier this hour, and I think what Michael Polson is talking about is more transparency and just a full explanation for possible donors about the possible risks, what we do know, what we don't know. And he was a little concerned that safety was being sort of oversold and the risk being undersold. Not at all saying don't donate. That wasn't the message at all. He was just relating his own experience going through the process and how he looks back on it. So after this short break, we'll talk to Aaron and Annette about that conversation, about making sure they understood what the research does and doesn't say and how they kind of came to terms with what they should expect. We'll also talk to Erica Venero, who's clinical manager for kidney transplant in the URMC Division of Solid Organ Transplant, and Dr. Jeremy Taylor, clinical director of nephrology for the URMC Division of Solid Organ Transplant, about those conversations, about what people who are thinking about donating should know and what the research does and doesn't say. And we're going to hear phone calls as well. Jan and others who might want to weigh in on this subject, we will get to those right after the only break of the hour right here on Connections. Let me tell you what's coming up Thursday on the show. We talk with Michael Kink, who's the executive director of the Strong Economy for All. That's a labor community coalition focused on economic fairness. He's looking ahead into the next 4 years of the Trump administration and what Trump's policies will mean for taxes, the minimum wage, and money in politics. He's going to speak in Rochester tomorrow night, but first, he is our guest tomorrow on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and waiting to join the conversation in Henrietta, this is Jan. Go ahead, Jan.
Yes, I was a kidney donor in 1983 for my brother. And that was in the really dark days yet of transplantation. Cyclosporin and some of the other anti-rejection drugs had not yet been developed. The workup, as some of your guests have already said, was really extensive to determine whether I was in really good physical health. The risks were portrayed to me at that time that, based on actuarial tables of men in military and accident victims who had lost one kidney, there had been no difference in life expectancy. So that reassured me. They also said there was no problem with future pregnancy or things like that, and I was only 29 at the time, so I was concerned. I went on to have two children. A year after the transplant, I was backpacking. So I also had no negative consequences to the transplant. I'm 62 now, and I'm still remarkably healthy. And it was also a very affirming experience for me personally. When you talk about was there relief when they thought the transplant wasn't going to go through, we had to have donor-specific transfusions in those days to see how my brother would accept my kidney, and we didn't know until 2 weeks before the surgery done by Dr. Sidney and Roland Anthone out in Buffalo whether it was going to go or not. And so I really, really wanted this to happen. However, the day that I was to go to the hospital, I remember physically shaking and thinking, this is too weird. I'm perfectly healthy, and I'm going to go have surgery. This is just a very weird thing. So there are definitely some conflicted feelings throughout the whole process, sometimes a lot of ups and downs, but very edifying. And my brother had 17 years of healthy life after the transplant, and he was essentially dying at the time of the transplant.
Jan, can I just ask you, yes. Have you had any long-term follow-up, to kind of just review your own situation? This is another place I'm very ignorant about, long-term follow-up.
Actually, that's what I had told the screener when I wanted to talk about. I was very surprised that there was no long-term follow-up for me from the transplant team. There was, of course, my own personal physician has always kept a very careful check on anything that has anything to do with kidneys, like blood pressure, like blood counts, like the glomerular filtration rate, all those sorts of things. But they never followed up through the transplant center. And that always surprised me because I thought we were missing very good information that all of us should be aware of as donors. So no, there was no, and I remember calling once out to Buffalo and saying, is there any places this, like my blood test should be registered? And they said, no, that was probably 15 years ago, so perhaps there is now.
Well, Jan, thanks for the phone call, and thanks for sharing your story. I feel the same way about you as I do about Aaron and Annette. I just admire the decision you made, and thank you for taking the time to call the program.
You're quite welcome.
All right, that's another sort of data point here, Dr. Taylor. Let's talk a little bit about long-term follow-up, and then we'll kind of work back towards conversations with potential donors. What kind of long-term follow-up is going on, and what kind of long-term follow-up should be going on with donors?
Yes, currently transplant centers are required to follow donors for 2 years. And Aaron, I know, is going through that process already. So once that 2 years is up, generally then the follow-up is done through their primary care physicians. I think that may change in the future. I mean, I think there probably are reasons to follow the donors longer than that, particularly as this new data is coming out suggesting that there may be some attributable risk to donating a kidney. And I think with that new data, I think it's certainly going to be reasonable for transplant centers to follow the donors longer than that. But currently, most transplant centers across the country are required to follow for 2 years. And at that point in time, it's usually then the primary carers that follow beyond that.
Okay. Well, let me ask Aaron Mattil then, when it came to donating a kidney, you mentioned going through that process step by step, stage by stage. What questions did you have? And that as well, I should ask your wife again, what questions you might have had together about possible long-term complications, life expectancy, anything. What was on your mind to make sure that you understood before you went through this process?
I think the biggest question was, is there anything about my daily life that I'm going to really have to change or do differently. And this wasn't necessarily a deal breaker, but I really haven't had to change my lifestyle at all. Some of the concerns were that were presented to us were a little bit about, you know, losing employment or losing benefits, you know, in the future for pre-existing conditions or things like that. And we decided those were risks worth taking. We were almost inundated with information. I mean, the strong team was very thorough with me, very, the support was fantastic, and they were available to meet with us or answer questions. I did a lot of emailing of questions when things would come up, or my support system, my wife and my parents would ask me to ask questions, and I would do that, and they would all get right back to me. They really needed me to convince them that I was ready for this, and I didn't feel like there was any information that I missed or wasn't given, and I still don't. As listening to your interview with Michael earlier, I mean, I was wondering, is there something he's going to say that's going to give me pause to think about, you know, what have I done? And I don't. I don't have any regrets. I never had a hesitation, and I still don't.
Okay. And now, when you thought about your wife making this donation, did you think, I want to know about life expectancy? Or there's anything else that stood out for you that you wanted to clear up?
I think the only question that was really in my mind was, well, what happens if she does have kidney failure? Like, you know, and from what they told us was she'd be at the top of the list because there's a term for it or something.
Is there priority for donors?
Yeah,
there is. Yeah, there's priority for previous donors.
Okay. Okay. So, and that was a big thing for you.
Yeah,
okay.
Definitely. Because, you know, obviously if there's one, she doesn't have the other one to back her up anymore. So I just wanted to verify that. And that was one of my biggest questions for them.
Okay. Okay. So they felt like the information that they were seeking, they could get. Let me ask those on the medical side, what information don't we have, or at least what do we need a better understanding of so we can make more declarative statements about what can be expected? What's the research that either has been done or needs to be done?
And I think the research really is, you know, it's being done now, or at least starting to be done. But the problem is a lot of this research, again, takes years and years.
Sure.
I mean, it takes 30, 40, 50 years until we can get a lifetime risk. And they're now, because of these more recent studies, there now are some risk calculators that we can use where, you know, donors can come in and we can sort of look at some of their health characteristics and sort of say, you know, this is what we anticipate your lifetime risk of kidney disease is going to be. You know, and the risks are still extremely small, you know, even for the very healthy donors, even though we may say, you know, if you didn't donate, you know, your risk is going to be this. But if you donated, the risk might go up a very small fraction. It's still, compared to the absolute risk, is an extremely small number. But I think what we really just need is we need more time. And we need to be able to follow these donors. You know, we need to have, a registry so that all these donors are sort of on a registry so we're tracking all the donors, which I think we're doing a better job of now. And as we gather more information and get more time, we'll be able to sort of tell patients, you know, really what, and we give them a better understanding of what that risk is.
Okay. Alexis emails the program and just wants to know how many people have kidney failure in their life. I guess a percentage is maybe what she's wondering. How many people will go through life and experience a need for this?
I mean, it varies a little bit based on the population. Kidney failure, you know, there are about 600,000 people in the United States on dialysis. So at about 300 million people. So that sort of is the risk of at least end-stage renal disease. There's a variety of other sort of lower level, you know, kidney failure or kidney disease that's a much higher risk than that. But the rate of actually end-stage renal disease, again, is this, you know, 600,000 people out of 300 million for the United States.
Can I ask, Aaron, just to follow up on one other point? When it came to employment, you mentioned a little bit of a concern about employment. Were you worried that this donation, making this donation, could impact you at work in any way? That was there anything when it came to future employment? Did you have a supportive employer? You know, can you speak to that a little bit?
I did have a supportive employer. My boss was actually quite good about it, very flexible with me on the times I needed to take off and to get tests or what have you, and allowing me to make up the time. I really wasn't concerned about my current employment. But certainly it's something you think about. If I'm in a position to have to change employment in the future, you know, there's things you disclose that people form ideas around, and you don't know. I don't know. If I have to change insurance at some point, are they going to – is that going to be an issue for me to be insured? I mean – but I guess to me, those aren't things that you can let stand in the way of doing something that you have a strong need to do. But it's in the back of your mind for sure.
How long is the average recovery, or what would we tell possible donors about what to expect when it comes to recovery?
So we tell donors that on average it's about 4 to 6 weeks before they're able to return back to work and kind of their daily lives. Usually the first 2 weeks are, and I'm sure Aaron can contribute, the first 2 weeks are the hardest, where getting out of bed and taking a shower is a victory for the day.
Just soreness and fatigue?
Just soreness and fatigue mostly.
Okay, so 4 to 6 weeks, and then after that you tell them that, you know,
You go on and you live your life, and you know, your body will tell you when you've had too much. And again, most donors, you know, as Aaron had said, they really feel like they're completely back to themselves around that 3 month mark. But they, you know, they go out, they enjoy their lives, and, you know, we have to follow them up as regulated. And I always joke, I say, listen, everybody shows up the 1 week appointment and the 1 month appointment and the 6 month appointment, and everybody shows up for the 1 year appointment. And then when the 2 year appointment comes around, it's very common for donors to go, gosh, has it been 2 years already? Like, it's gone right by me. Because they're out living their lives and they're not thinking about, you know, that they've donated a kidney.
All right. So do you have people who are runners, marathon runners who donate?
Oh, we have quite a few. Absolutely. Yeah? We actually had a donor and a recipient pair actually run the Rochester Marathon together. So absolutely.
That's cool.
Everybody in the room lit up with that story. That's a good one. Yanti, you going to run any marathons?
I'll walk some. Not a runner.
I'll drive behind you.
There we go. That works.
Jake writes to the program and wants to know, are there any stats on the number of recipients who previously donated a kidney? And that would be a valuable data point. So a recipient who has previously donated, or recipients or donors who end up needing a kidney, I guess. He's wondering about if we have numbers on that.
Those numbers are probably available. I don't know them off the top of my head. And again, I think those numbers are probably available for the past 20 years. I think if you go back beyond that, some of those patients may have been lost to follow-up, or at least not as well documented. But they're certainly the number is very few. It's a very small number that of people who have actually donated that have actually then developed end-stage renal disease and have needed a kidney transplant or ended up on dialysis. But again, those numbers are available.
Well, we've got a few minutes left, so let me just ask Yanti Slobert, who is a kidney transplant recipient, May 10th, who is feeling great these days here. When you look at the donor community, you look at someone like Erin and her family, what does it mean to people in this stage here? I mean, it's easy for us to kind of go through life if we never need or if we never know someone who needs. What does it mean to you?
Obviously, it's a second chance at life. For me, it's a second chance to be a father, a second chance to be a great husband, a son, a sibling. You just look at life in a totally new way, and you just want to live it to its fullest. It means the world. From being able, from not being able to get out of bed to actually lifting my son. After the kidney transplant, I could not lift him for a number of weeks. And then when I was given the permission, oh, yeah, go ahead and pick up your 40-pound son, it was the best day of my life. It was the best day of my life because we were not able to lift anything past 10 pounds. So just having that ability to start living my life and living a life that I know I desire to live, you can't put a price on it.
Before you had to go through this process, how much had you thought in your own life about, you know, being an organ donor, having signed up, you know, those kind of things? Was that even on your radar?
No, not at all. Not until a friend of ours, brother, died in a bike accident, and he donated his organs. Mm-hmm. And then I went from being an unbeliever to just believing, like, you know what, he saved so many lives. Let's just sign up, too. And then not knowing in the future I would be the person in need. So it took him to give up his life for me to change my mind.
Wow. How many years passed between those two events, between the need?
Maybe 10 years.
Wow.
Maybe 10 years.
Wow. And so, yes. And so now here you are. And any message you want to send to people who are just like you and so many people, just not really thinking about it?
Right now, I feel like we have a purpose. Now I've received my donor. I received my kidney, and I want to make sure other people receive theirs. Don't give up. There are angels really on this planet who are generous, and there are great physicians that will help you through the steps. And just keep believing that things can change. Your world will be better. It can be better.
That whole swap thing is amazing to me too, by the way, Yanti.
Yes.
Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing.
I mean, when you heard it was even possible, that probably had to be like, look, I finally get someone who's willing to do this for me.
Right.
It's not a match.
Yes.
What an amazing way to do it. I didn't even, until Corey Putnam's article in the Democrat and Chronicle, I didn't even know that that was a thing.
Right, right. And that's our purpose, to get the word out, to get the message out, to let people know that it is a possibility for you to receive it, even if your family member can't do it for you. So it was frustrating to hear, like, and I kept complaining, like, wait a minute, I have a donor. What's going on? What's taking so long? Oh, you're a big guy. Not anymore. I'm only 181.
You had gone to 181. You
yes.
had lost how? You'd lost 60, 70 pounds?
Over 100 pounds.
Over 100
yes,
pounds?
Yes, yes, yes.
Wow. Well, all I'm going to say now is you look healthy. You look good.
I am healthy. I am healthy.
You look
yes.
very good. And I'm so happy for you. I just admire you and Aaron and Annette. What a remarkable story. Thank you for being here and sharing it and letting our audience know about the options that may not even be sort of on people's radar. So thank you.
Thank
Great
you.
Meeting
thank
you, Aaron
you.
And Annette. Thank you. Good luck to you, Yanti.
Thank you.
Continued good health to you. Dr. Jeremy Taylor, thanks for all the information, the knowledge this hour.
Great. Thank you very much for having us.
And Eric Venero, thank you so much for being here as well.
My pleasure.
And our thanks to Michael Polson, too. You know, he wrote this piece. He didn't choose the headline of the piece. He has a lot of people talking, and I think it's valuable to understand risk, but also the rewards. And you're seeing that in this room this hour. Thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer of this broadcast. And I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon, and we'll talk to you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.